Chumba.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply. I was raised in a very strict and religious environment. A lot of you have heard the story of my upbringing and how it involved a literal doomsday cult for 6 or 7 years of my life, though I don't think that anybody within the group would necessarily call it a cult. When you put it all together, it pretty much was. And in and out of my life came these bizarre strangers with strange backgrounds and no women. Very strange how there were no women. Just a bunch of guys with guns and criminal records and radical Christian beliefs that, if all else failed, would die with them as they took the cyanide pills or held off those black armor-clad strangers that would inevitably come to behead us. Dreams were treated as doctrine, and fake visions and mysterious callings and unexplainable side quests that seemed to bring me anywhere but closer to God abounded. As a matter of fact, it made me deathly afraid of God, this whole situation. God was the ruthless figure in the sky who punished, but at the same time loved, and yet somehow the fear of the punishment always found a way to drown out that unfathomable love that he had for me. Unfortunately, the world I was involved in managed to attract the opposite kind of attention than was intended. As I got older and into my teen years, I began to pull away from God. I became violent. I wanted nothing to do with Christianity. And by the time I was in my early 20s, I was practicing various degrees of magic. And I would regularly pray to or commune with the dead or demons or who I thought was Satan. I had idols in my home. I became heavily involved in self-harm and believed my blood would set me free. I became very superstitious, and even to this day, I battle some of the scars of superstition. Needless to say, I read many books on the matter and did copious amounts of research, eventually getting into the actual rituals I was reading about myself. And I even eventually married somebody later in life who was sort of a green witch and came from a family that had other witches within it. And they're from a land that believes in magic in a much bigger way than we do here in the United States. In the U.S., people often have a sort of Disneyfied perception of what magic is. But if you go to some of these other countries that are far beyond the reaches of first world civilization, you kind of find that this world is much deeper, darker, and more powerful than you might imagine. Magic is one of the oldest ways that human beings tried to speak to the invisible. So long before there were laboratories or microscopes or universities or scientific journals, people looked at things like sickness and storms and dreams and eclipses and death and madness, love, famine, war, and they understood that the world is not just physical. It was alive with forces, and some were divine and some were hostile. Some remained hidden and some liked to be seen. There were those that could be petitioned and interpreted and resisted or even manipulated at times. Magic began in that strange gray space, that territory between fear and knowledge, where human beings admitted that reality had layers that they could not fully control or understand, but still refused to stand helpless before those layers. The earliest literate cultures, they didn't treat magic as fantasy. They treated it as a sort of practical technology, if you will, of survival. And they had charms and spells, omens, rituals, objects that could do things, divination, and sacred and magical words. And these were all things that were used to interpret and influence the forces of nature. Even societies without writing left behind their cave art and their carved objects and their burial goods and ritual spaces that nowadays we interpret as having magical or spiritual purposes to those people back then. However, they were just misguided and magic isn't real. So whether those interpretations are always correct is a question of, in of itself, but the pattern that we see here is difficult to just ignore, and in my opinion, not something you can just explain away with the blanket statement that all past human beings were just so ignorant that they turned to magic. Wherever human beings appear, so does ritual, so does magic. And wherever people die, there's an attempt to speak beyond death. Wherever there is danger of some type, there are protective spells. And if there's uncertainty, then there is a call for divination. For most of history, magic and science were not necessarily enemies, but rather they were neighbors, and often they were practiced by the same kinds of people. Astrology studied the heavens not simply as distant lights that are unreachable, but as actual meaningful signs. Of course, you guys have probably heard of alchemy. Alchemy studied matter not only to manipulate metals, but also to understand transformation itself. And then you have things like medicine, religion, astronomy, and mathematics, and ritual, and philosophy that were often braided together into one single worldview. So the idea that magic and science must be completely separate is a relatively late and new concept. It was the scientific revolution, especially in the late European Renaissance and early modern period, that began drawing these harder lines. But repeatable observation and measurement and all of these experiments, well, they became the standard for what people began to call legitimate knowledge. So magic lost its prestige, but it didn't disappear. It just simply went underground, it adapted, it hid itself, and it survived in folk practice, and later it reemerged among occultists who tried to reconcile ancient ritual with the modern scientific imagination. And of course, we all know somebody who believes that they are practicing some kind of magic. It doesn't need to necessarily be something that is some taboo, ceremonial circle deep under the ground by robed figures or anything like that. Magic has many, many different forms. In ancient Mesopotamia, magic wasn't even treated as anything that was childish or superstition. It was one of the main defenses against what they considered a dangerous universe. The people of Mesopotamia believed that human life could literally be affected by gods and demons and ghosts and curses, evil omens and hostile sorcery. If a person became sick or unlucky or haunted or maybe spiritually polluted, the solution was not really medical or moral, it was ritual. The Mesopotamians practiced what we might call defensive magic, known in Akkadian as Aseputu or Masmasutu. And these were essentially incantations and ritual procedures that were designed to change a specific reality to something else. And to the ancient mind, this was not imagination or make-believe, it was more like an intervention. One of the most revealing things about Mesopotamian magic is that it didn't divide the world neatly into like black magic and white magic the way that later cultures sometimes would. The same techniques could be used legitimately or illegitimately. It's kind of like a hammer. You can use it to smash somebody's skull open, or you can use it to build a house. The difference was not always in the method, it was in the purpose and who was wielding it, the authority, the openness of the act. A curse? Yeah, that was usually a secret thing. It was hidden and suspicious and socially dangerous, and it would take quite a bit for somebody to openly be like, "I curse your entire family line." A ritual defense against a curse, by contrast, would be performed publicly. It could be witnessed. It was not shameful. It was justice and considered good magic. The ritual known as makiu, meaning the burning, shows how serious this worldview really was, because a person who believed that they were afflicted by witchcraft might create an effigy of the sorcerer, and the effigy would be put on trial at night, as though the invisible crime had to be essentially dragged into a very visible court. And once these accusations had been established, the effigy, the figure, it was burned. And this burning was not just a symbolic thing in the modern sense, but it was actually understood as an act that broke the sorcerer's power. And the image, or the word, and the ritual were quite literally connected to reality. Another ritual, known as sorpu, also meaning burning, didn't deal with an enemy sorcerer, but with the burden of some kind of unknown guilt. A person might believe that they had committed sins or offenses without even knowing it. Perhaps they had angered a god, or they had violated some taboo. Maybe some unseen disorder had attached itself to them. And in this ritual, guilt could quite literally be transferred onto objects such as a strip of dates, or an onion, or a tuft of wool. And these objects were then burned, which would carry the pollution away. And the point of this was purification. The person wasn't just trying to feel better, they were trying to restore order between themselves, the gods, and this unseen structure of the world. Mesopotamian magic also entered the intimate parts of life. There were love spells and rituals to restore affection, or spells to cause desire, and kind of even formulas related to sexual potency. Other rituals obviously sought reconciliation between a person and their patron deity, or between a husband and a wife. And we've seen all of these films, these horror movies where, you know, magic or something, wishes or whatever. I think Obsession even has something to do with this. This film that just came out by Curry has something to do with these sort of wishes or spells that make somebody love you. And this tells us something pretty important. Ancient magic, it wasn't just about demons and curses. It was literally about ordinary human desperation, love fading, you know, a marriage breaking, bodies failing, getting older, a god seeming distant. The same world that needed all of these exorcists, it also needed healers and counselors and interpreters of meaning. The specialist who performed many of these rites was the Esipu, who was an expert in magic and ritual knowledge. And the Esipu was not just, you know, your regular stage magician or village eccentric weirdo. He could be a scholar or a physician, a priest, an advisor. He could be a scribe. And the role was often inherited through families and held in high regard. So kings and rulers, they could depend on such experts because power in the ancient world was never purely political. A kingdom, it could be threatened by armies and famine and disease and all of these things. But to rule well, one needed soldiers and scribes and also interpreters of the invisible. The Mesopotamian gods themselves were linked with magic. Enki, who I'm sure many of us have heard of, later associated with the East Semitic god Ea, was especially connected with wisdom and these incantations and secret knowledge. He was understood as a source of arcane understanding and the divine patron, essentially, behind the arts of ritual specialists. And this is important because it shows that magic wasn't always viewed as rebellion against religion as we see it today. In many ancient cultures, magic was actually inside religion. It was one of the ways sacred power moved through the world. And that's why the church is so important today, because they walk that line quite a bit of the time. Omens were another major part of the Mesopotamian thought. Some omens were sought deliberately through divination, while others appeared without even being asked for. Either way, they were taken pretty seriously. So if there was a strange birth or a dream or some kind of pattern in the liver of a sacrificed animal, of course things like signs in the sky, eclipses, deformities on bodies, a sudden event that was unexpected, all of this stuff could be read as signs, and the world was not seen as just something that never spoke to human beings, some rock that we all live on. It was speaking constantly, and the problem was whether anybody knew how to read it at all. The ancient need for protection it's easy to see then, continued in later magical traditions of the Middle East. And one striking example is the incantation bowl, which is sometimes called just simply the magic bowl. And these bowls were especially common in parts of Mesopotamia and Syria, and of course Iraq and Iran during the late antiquity age, and particularly around the 6th to 8th centuries too. And they were often inscribed with protective texts. They were buried face down under thresholds. They were handled very carefully. They were put in courtyards and homes or near graveyards or places of burial. And their purpose was to trap or to repel harmful spirits that were in these areas. This bowl, it wasn't a decoration. It was an actual spiritual device placed at the what were considered the vulnerable edges of the home, where danger might actually cross in from outside.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
And then, of course, as with all things in this sort of this area of life, this area of study, as with all things that are strange and weird and supernatural, it somehow leads back to ancient Egypt, where, of course, magic was just as central to civilization and society. But it did have its own language and personality. The Egyptian term was heka. And unlike later ideas of magic as something suspicious or forbidden, heka wasn't even seen as evil. It was a cosmic force. It was a divine gift. It was part of how reality functioned. Magic was so important that it was personified as a god. So to understand Egypt without heka is almost impossible, because Egyptian religion and medicine and their funerary practices and their kingships and all this, the rituals that were involved in these things, they all depended on the belief that words and actions could participate in the structure of creation. The Egyptian creator brought the world into being through divine speech, and that idea gave words enormous power. Speech was not just something that people communicated with, it was creation itself. So a properly spoken formula or written spell or ritual phrase could do something, and it could protect somebody, it could transform something, it could awaken the dead, it could command or guide or preserve. Human beings were understood as images of the divine, and because of that, they shared in limited form the creative power of speech. So to speak rightly then was to basically act upon reality. Is it starting to make sense how, you know, when we as believers, I'm a believer in God, the creator, Yahushua and all this kind of stuff, if we believe in this kind of stuff and we look at the pagans, the pagan beliefs, the ancient Egyptians, the Mesopotamians, the Akkadians, all this kind of stuff, and we think, oh, they were in some sort of rebellion against God, yes, they were, but at the same time, it's getting easier and easier to see, hopefully, how they didn't even know that they were in rebellion against some one God. As a matter of fact, they thought that they were on the side of the one God. And by doing these things, performing these rituals and doing this magic, they actually thought they were saving their bodies and souls as well. This is the deception of false gods. This is how powerful it actually is. And it can build entire civilizations, great ones, such as the Romans, the Greeks, the Akkadians, and of course, the Egyptians. But all of this is why Egyptian magic cannot be separated from writing. Hieroglyphs were not just these signs on a wall that tourists would later come and see and be like, ooh, I wonder what they mean. They had presence. They carried force. And you can kind of, if you have an open mind, when you see these signs and symbols, these hieroglyphs, it's easy to see that they were important to the Egyptians. And names were especially powerful. To know the name of a thing was to have access to its essence. So to preserve a name was to preserve a life. And if you erase a name, it was considered an attack on existence itself. In this worldview, memory and language and even survival were all bound together. Magic in Egypt was also practiced at every level of society. Priests, they used it in the temples, and then healers used it in medical contexts. But farmers, herdsmen, mothers, and even ordinary people used protective formulas and amulets on a widespread basis. It was not limited to the elites, even though, you know, literacy gave priests and scribes special access to other written spells and ritual knowledge that maybe your general laborer didn't really know about. But the principle of Heka operated in both official religion and private life, and the temple and the household were different spaces, but both existed in a universe where unseen powers had to be honored and managed. Now, like I said before, I am a believer in Jesus Christ. The one creator God is my God. And so obviously everything that I'm speaking about, I'm speaking from the mindset of being a believer in Jesus Christ and Yahushua, as he is called. And I want to make that abundantly clear, because I don't want it to seem like I am like supporting all of these other magics. But what I am doing is showing you how powerful these other magics were, and that they were not just some little thing that witches do on, you know, Halloween with their body parts that they've collected from the woods or from the children, and putting them in their cauldron with these special mushrooms and moon water. That is a very Disneyfied version of magic. Instead, what I would like you to see in this presentation, which is really just me talking because I'm not even actually here, you're just imagining me, but what I'm really trying to show you here is that this type of, like, magic forms civilizations. It's not fake. Even if you don't believe in a magic, well, like a prince turning into a frog or vice versa, it is kind of like still something that is very, very real in the way that it shapes the mentalities of entire civilizations, and not just any civilizations, but the greatest civilizations of all time. And so when we see religions today, we should view them as magics, because it is the same thing. It has always been the same thing. But getting back to the nitty-gritty, amulets were among the most widespread magical objects in Egypt, and I think that they are today as well. They were back then known as meket, and they were worn by the living, and they were also placed with the dead. And their purpose was protection, but also, you know, reassurance, like comforting. They affirmed that the universe had order, and that a person could align with that order. You might be thinking of how people have special little objects that they take with them everywhere, or rabbit foots that are lucky, and you know, maybe a little pocket idol, or some kind of bead or coin that you attribute powers to, or luck to, or you know, little effigies of saints, etc., etc., etc. They affirmed that the universe had order, and that a person could align with that order. Some amulets protected the body, others guarded the soul, others invoked very specific gods or symbols or powers, and the use of these amulets stretches far back into the pre-dynastic period and continued for thousands of years up until this very day. And that long continuity, in my opinion, says something pretty profound. It says that across empires and dynasties and invasions and cultural changes, the old gods' influence remains, and the human desire for protection remains, and they will constantly seek any way to achieve the comfort they need on this earth, on this prison planet of doom, even if it is in some non-moving object, some immobile, unthinking solid object made of metal or stone or what wood, whatever. Now, perhaps the most famous Egyptian magical text is what we now call the Book of the Dead. I've got a copy here in my office, and it is pretty crazy. It was not a single book in the modern sense, but it was kind of a collection of spells and prayers, these declarations and instructions that were designed to help the dead navigate the afterlife. And these texts gave the deceased the words that they would need in the world beyond the tomb. They helped the soul pass through the dangers that it would inevitably encounter. They would answer divine beings and preserve the body and avoid destruction and eventually reach a blessed existence. The dead were not simply gone. They were travelers, and like any traveler entering a dangerous country, they needed the knowledge, passwords, protection, and guidance to get through said country. What makes the history of magic so fascinating is that it reveals a version of humanity that modern people often pretend that they have outgrown. Ancient magic was not some random nonsense to the people who practice it. It was a system of meaning, and to this day, it still is. It was a way of confronting sickness, guilt, grief, love, political anxiety, death, and, of course, the terror of unseen forces in the woods or the desert or wherever you may be. It gave a structure to fear. It gave a language to the suffering that people were experiencing and something to do when the world felt hostile and mysterious and against them. I recommend everybody look at their own personal beliefs, because it doesn't have to be some organized religion like Christianity or Islam or Buddhism or any of these to be considered like magic. Look at your own beliefs. Do you have any attributes of magical quality that you have just kind of applied to yourself because it makes you feel more comfortable? And I'm not saying this in a judgmental way at all. I'm just saying, like, literally, like, look at your life. Like, look, like, when I look around my room right now, one of the things that I do is I carry around a little pocket Bible in my pocket. Could that be considered magic to other people? Like, people who follow Islam, will they see that as me performing magic? Perhaps. To me, I don't consider it magic, but the Bible does bring me comfort. It's a very interesting paradigm when you think about it. But, obviously, I don't see it as magic at all, because I believe that my God is the one God, right? And so, every religion will function in that way. Every religion has magic, inherently. Because those things that man do to spirituality create this weird world where they think that they can control the gods or please the gods or make the gods pay attention to them or impact the spiritual realm, whether it's demons or creatures or spirits or ghosts or, you know, the souls of the ancestors, whatever it is. It's very interesting how magic kind of just becomes naturally applied. It's not always spells and magic words and special incantations and stuff like that. That is definitely an attribute of it. But the very act of having a talisman is practicing a degree of magic. It's fascinating. Modern science obviously has changed how many people explain reality, but it hasn't erased these old instincts. And I think that that is a very loud fireworks display of how the spirit realm is real and that magic is real. And all of this that I've been speaking about is real, despite what science would say. It is hardwired inside humanity to believe in the spiritual realm and the concept that they could interact with it. People still look for signs. They carry their lucky objects. They speak the words over the sick. They still perform rituals before they do something dangerous, and they feel that names matter, that symbols matter. Places can be changed or charged or whatever with memories and incantations, and that the dead are not easily just forgotten once they're gone, that sometimes they are watching over us, etc., etc. All these unseen forces, they're kind of moving beneath visible events. So maybe the way we talk about it has changed, but that world has not. It is still very much constant. And we see signs and symbols in movies, in books, in billboard signs, everywhere. Everybody believes in this stuff. Whether or not they speak it out loud is what's up for debate. But like, everybody kind of believes in something like this, I think. I just don't know if they really know that they do. But the history of magic is not something that is just a history of spells, which is what I'm trying to say. It's the history of human beings sort of standing at the edge of the unknown and trying to negotiate with it. It's a grappling with mortality. It's sometimes they did this stuff with bowls or beneath their homes, but sometimes they just uttered words to themselves as they went through difficult times. Sometimes they burned their effigies. Sometimes amulets were pressed against parts of their body, and they believed that it would cause healing or pull a demon out. You know, sacred words that were written for their ancestors so that their ancestors might not forget them and be proud of them. And behind all of this is the same ancient question.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
What if reality is not moot, it's not silence, and what if the right word or the right sign or the right ritual spoken at the right time or, you know, with the right ingredients and the recipe concocted for these special moments, whatever, what if it can actually reach into the spirit realm and pull something into this world that will benefit them? Now, there are some magics that are just much creepier and scarier than others. And on the first one that comes to my mind when I say this is obviously voodoo. There are forms of death that appear at first glance to belong entirely to the realm of superstition. A curse could be spoken, or a bone pointed in a specific direction, or a medicine man condemning some kind of victim, and a person becomes convinced that unseen powers have essentially turned against them. And then, without any sort of wound or injury or sickness, the person just becomes weaker. They withdraw, they refuse food and water, and eventually they just die. And to the modern mind, this does seem impossible. If you haven't seen it, it's hard to believe. Personally, I've seen some pretty wild shapes and forms of magic, and voodoo is one of those ones that is just, it's hard to argue with the danger of it. Death is supposed to have some kind of visible cause, like a wound or a sickness or some kind of failing organ or poison or something. But something that inevitably can be named is what I'm trying to say. Something that can be measured, or we can give the excuse for this is why the person died. But across many parts of the world, anthropologists and missionaries and physicians and even colonial observers have reported what came to be called a voodoo death, which is essentially a death that apparently was not caused by physical injury, but by actual terror or social condemnation or some kind of overwhelming conviction that death is just unavoidable and it's coming for me. Now, reports of this phenomenon appear among indigenous peoples of South America, Africa, Australia, New Zealand, the Pacific Islands, and Haiti. Oftentimes, it's even seen in New Orleans and stuff like that. The terminology that is used in older writings is often dated and culturally loaded, but there is a central question that I think needs to be asked, which is, can a human being die because they believe they have been cursed? Or is it something much more horrifying? Is there something actually killing them in the spirit realm? Is the witch responsible? Or is the mental manipulation of these concepts of magic and spirituality to blame? Am I making any sense here? I don't know. The answer is not very simple because we don't really know, and it kind of depends on your belief. I spent a lot of time in South America, and so in that area, early observers described deaths among the Tupinamba, in which a chief or medicine man condemned a person and the victim then died afterward from fright, from being horrified to death. And the supposed mechanism, of course, was supernatural power. But the visible social effect was kind of something more like intimidation. The victim wasn't just afraid of one man. He was allegedly afraid of a whole cosmology. He was trapped inside of a world where the medicine man's words carried some kind of spiritual authority, and where the tribe recognized that authority, and where the condemned person understood himself as already sentenced to death. So the true terror in these kinds of cases isn't just personal fear, but it's total social confirmation that you are effed and that you are cursed. And everyone around the victim believed that this curse mattered, and they didn't want to get too close. It was kind of like tuberculosis. You might catch it. Everyone understood the sentence. Everybody knew what was supposed to happen next, and the cursed person, he wasn't just scared, he was placed inside a sort of communal script of death. Similar stories appear in New Zealand among the Maori people, especially in relation to tapu or taboo. In one account, a Maori woman ate fruit and she was later told that it had come from a tabooed place, a cursed place. And once she believed that the sacred authority of a chief had essentially been violated, she announced that his spirit would most certainly kill her, and wouldn't you know it, by noon the next day, she was dead. And this raises some interesting questions in my mind, such as, if a person believes strongly enough that they are cursed or that they have done something curse worthy, does that belief kill them? Or does something from the spiritual realm step in, and in that environment of spiritual sensitivity within this person, are they able to actually kill that human being? Another observer described seeing a strong young man die the same day that he had been placed under tapu, as though his strength had just drained out of him like water, going from a young man to essentially a senile old man. And that image is one of the most haunting in my mind in this entire subject matter, because strength running out like water suggest that there isn't a theatrical collapse, but an actual slow sort of internal surrender, a vampiric overtaking. The victim doesn't just fall dead like he's been shot by an arrow. He fades. He collapses. He withdraws from food. He pulls away from everything that would keep him alive. He stops moving about. He stops being able to speak, and hope itself just evaporates from him. His body appears to remain alive, but his expectation of survival is just completely gone. And again, what kills this person? Is it the belief that they have no hope? the total vanquishing of faith? Or is it a demon? Like, what exactly is responsible in this moment for the death of these individuals? One of the most striking recorded cases comes from New Queensland, where Dr. S.M. Lambert of the Western Pacific Health Service encountered a native convert named Rob. And Rob had been told that a famous witch doctor named Nebo had pointed a bone at him. And in the local belief system, this is not just like an insult or an FU. It was a death sentence, and Rob became severely weakened when he became aware of this. And when examined, he didn't show any signs that he was ill. He didn't have any fevers or pains or diseases or any injuries or anything, but he appeared seriously ill. So Dr. Lambert and the missionary that he was with confronted Nebo and threatened consequences if Rob died. And Nebo agreed to visit Rob, and he leaned over him and told him that the whole thing had been a mistake, even a joke perhaps. And he said that he had never pointed the bone at him at all, and Rob's recovery was nearly immediate. So, very strange, and by that evening, Rob was back at work, happy, physically restored, perhaps even stronger than he was before, because all hope had returned. So, this case is important because just as fear appears to be able to damage the body to the point of no return, it also seems to suggest that relief from fear, faith, hope, etc., can actually reverse the process of death. And the curse worked because Rob believed that it was real. The curse worked because the authority behind the curse withdrew that curse. The body followed the command structure of what the mind believed. And of course, any serious examination of these cases should begin with every type of caution you can imagine. Poisoning has to be ruled out. Natural illness has to be ruled out. All the things about fraud and exaggeration, coincidence, all these, you know, the retrospective storytelling, all of this has to be considered. But in societies where illness is often attributed to malevolent spiritual forces, a person might actually die from ordinary disease and it later be said to have died from sorcery. They might have later been said to have died from sorcery. Remember COVID? Kind of reminds me of that. Everybody was saying that gunshot victims were dying of COVID. That's just kind of a non-spiritual version of this. But I digress. It doesn't prove that sorcery caused the death. It only proves that the death was interpreted through that belief system. But some medically trained observers do argue that poisoning and ordinary injury can explain every single case that of alleged cursing, okay? Dr. J.B. Clayland, he's a professor of pathology at the University of Adelaide. He wrote that Australian Aboriginal people did, from time to time, appear to actually die from bone pointing ceremonies without ordinary lethal wounds or detectable surgical complications. And he described cases in which a person slowly declined and died after being subjected to terrifying ritual acts. So if you look at it from this perspective, poison didn't really adequately explain these deaths, especially in the Central Australian context he described. And in Central Australia, there is all sorts of weird magics, by the way. But all of this still leaves the deeper question. If a curse does not kill by supernatural force, and if no poison or wound is present, then what is actually killing these people? Do these gods and demons and spirits and ghosts actually have a power that can take life out of existence? I don't know. But what happens, I think, is that when terror has no outlet, when a person is so terrified that they can't fight, they can't flee or argue or even save themselves, they can't escape the belief system because it has been hardwired inside of them, they can't regain any social support because everybody believes they are cursed and their gods are against them and there is nothing awaiting them but hell, they can't even imagine a situation in which they can survive this, let alone their soul go on. In that condition, the body might remain locked in a sort of prolonged state of alarm. The emergency system inside, it doesn't shut off. It just keeps going and going and going. It's a spiral. And the organism is sort of held in a state that is designed for short bursts of danger. So if you put them in this state that continually horrifies, continually terrifies, and drags them into this abysmal abyss where the danger is psychological and social and inescapable, well, the result could be catastrophic. In other words, death. So the victim of a curse or a taboo may become isolated from their people. And that isolation is pretty important because human beings aren't really built to experience reality alone. I know a lot of people will disagree with that. I also consider myself a bit of a lone wolf, but not in the way where it's like, society doesn't understand me or anything like that. But if the whole community believes, what I mean, that a person is doomed, then the doomed person doesn't just lose their confidence that they can overcome this. They lose the social world that once held them in place. They lose their God. They lose everything spiritual and physical about their life. The curse becomes more than just a fear. It's like their new identity, and that identity takes root inside of them as well. It literally is a parasite. It's a vampiric entity that gets inside and is designed to get inside by the society from which this taboo and this curse have originated. So in that condition, there are many victims that reportedly refuse to eat. They refuse all food. And of course, that weakens the body. Not drinking is even more dangerous. If they're not drinking water, dehydration reduces all of the circulating blood volume. And if the person is trapped in this extreme state of fear during this type of experience with the sympathetic adrenal system essentially overactivated, the blood vessels might remain constricted. And then the cardiovascular system may begin to fail, which could lead to a heart attack, but it looks like magical death from the outside. You know, it's kind of like shock could be killing them instead of the actual entity that has been summoned allegedly by a curse or something.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public would be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too. Because where you get your information matters.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Shock isn't just an emotional distress. In medical terms, a shock involves a failure of circulation. So the organs are not receiving enough blood and oxygen to function properly. And then the blood pressure falls, the heart weakens, you're not eating, you're not drinking, the brain and other vital organs required to keep you alive, they all suffer. And this vicious circle begins. Low blood pressure damages the organs needed to maintain the blood pressure. And as those organs deteriorate, circulation worsens further. And this is all without even considering the psychological war that is going on in your brain that is basically convincing yourself to die. Not kill yourself, it's basically convincing you to die. In the common cases of physical trauma, this process can also be caused by blood loss. But in the proposed explanation for voodoo death, the collapse is probably most likely coming from prolonged emotional strain, dehydration, and all of the physiological effects of terror. So the person dies not necessarily because the curse has some kind of magical power in itself, but because belief in the curse produces a crisis within the body that is powerful enough to kill the person. And this doesn't make, even though this sounds like a scientific explanation instead of a spiritual one, I disagree that it is that way. I think it is so physically, this is going to sound like a contradicting statement, so physically spiritual that it's deadly. It basically proves that magic is real. I know we want it to be like there's a magic spell, blah, 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 but this type of attack very much aligns with the types of attacks that we see in biblical accounts, in ancient accounts. And yes, there are different explanations for how curses work as humanity and society and civilization sort of go through their cycles of trying to explain the spiritual realm and how it impacts the physical. But if anything, what we're doing here is actually explaining how real magic and sorcery is, because it leads to death. So you can say, well, it's not a demon reaching out from the nether realm to kill the victim, so therefore magic is not real. But I would argue, well, what is it then? It's because something has killed the human being, and it's that something is fear, lack of hope, and lack of faith. To me, that is magic. It means that the boundary between the mind and the body is severed in a, well, not severed, but it's like reality is severed from the mind and the body, and the mind convinces the body to destroy itself because of a, if you want to say alleged, you can, alleged curse. That is magic working. Modern people have a really difficult time imagining this. Fear can literally become chemistry. The belief in this type of stuff can actually alter your bodily functions. Social rejection can literally trigger a biological collapse. Have you ever seen a homeless person who is like really going through it? A sentence of death, if believed deeply enough, can literally reinforce the idea, especially when it's being forced upon you by an entire community, that the body should be pushing itself into the abyss, into the fate that the curse has told it is going to enter, or it should enter. I hope this makes sense. Military psychiatry, by the way, has reported similar patterns under extreme conditions. During the Spanish War of 1936, the psychiatrist Mira described patients suffering from what he called malignant anxiety. And these patients experienced anguish and confusion. They experienced things like rapid pulse and breathing, exhaustion, the lack of food and water, and severe mental shock. And some of these people died within 3 or 4 days. Their condition was not identical to the ritual curse cases or voodoo, as we've been talking about, but the similarities are there on a biological level. Intense fear, physical depletion, and the human body trapped in emergency mode. It becomes lethal. And the disturbing implication is that voodoo death may not actually require any belief in magic to be taken seriously. I think the name may be misleading itself, voodoo death. The phenomenon, if this is real, it isn't proof that sorcerers possess some kind of supernatural killing power. If anything, it proves that everybody has supernatural killing power. It is evidence that human beings are vulnerable to meaning itself. Anybody can be a victim of magic, and anybody can wield it, because it is a weapon that is within oneself and it is basically a weapon of persuasion and manipulation. A person can be killed by a wound, a gunshot wound, a sword wound, sure. They can be killed by poison or destroyed by a world in which every symbol and every authority and every person in that society tells them that they are already dead or should be, even if it leads to suicide. So this is why the ritual context, I think, matters so much, and I hope I'm making sense, because I'm kind of just rattling off here. But bone pointing and curses and the taboo violations and all these condemnations, they're not random gestures of some magical world. They work within a cultural system where all of these symbols have force and meaning that are believed very, very deeply, or are surrounding us subconsciously and sometimes even in the waking world. A bone that has been pointed by, let's just say, an ordinary stranger, it might mean nothing, but a bone pointed by a recognized ritual specialist in a society that accepts the act as something that can literally cause death, well, that might mean everything. The weapon isn't the bone. The weapon is the belief structure surrounding it. Now, when you get into voodoo dolls and all that kind of stuff, that is a little bit different. And that might actually walk into the realm of demons sort of impacting the physical world in a very bodily way. So, let's just circle back around. Modern people are probably going to be tempted to look down on everything that I said and look down on these stories as relics of sort of a less rational age. But to me, that's kind of a cop-out. I think contemporary society has its own invisible magics, its own sentences that it wills upon people, a diagnosis that can crush a person before they even see symptoms. You feel like a social outcast. You feel like everybody and everything is against you. You feel like you're being gang stalked. You feel like you're being visited by entities. You feel like you're being hacked. That can lead people to some pretty drastic scenarios where they may actually die. And public humiliation can also destroy the will to live too. Isolation, like we already said, it weakens the immune system. Panic, it mimics heart attacks. If you are put into a state where you are feeling panicked, you are closer to death than when you are not. Stress that damages your ability to sleep or digest food or your cognition. Sure, maybe the symbols have changed and the magic words and phrases have been altered, but the body still listens because it is a part of us. That ancient curse and this modern prognosis, they probably operate in different languages than we recognize, but both reveal something that I consider very unsettling, and that is that the human organism, it doesn't respond to just physical things, physical facts. It responds also to how things are interpreted and believed and respected, and it responds to authority and expectation, and it responds to whether the surrounding area, the world, the civilization, the city, the village says you can survive or you are going to die because of whatever. And you know, the most chilling part about the voodoo death thing isn't that it's some exotic ritual. It's the idea that death can begin as a conclusion accepted by the mind before the body has even fully failed. The person who is being cursed will hear what is supposed to be happening to them, and the tribe will confirm it. The food and the water, all of a sudden, you're not hungry, you know, like just like loss of appetite, except it doesn't end. You know, sometimes people will be really hungry, and then somebody will say something to them, and they'll lose their appetite, right? Now imagine that the appetite doesn't come back. All hope is collapsing. Fear is remaining constant. It's not something that comes and goes. You can't escape the fear. The body, the emergency signals that the body provides, they deprive the person of restoration. So the body begins to break down. And eventually, the invisible becomes visible. You start seeing things. You start hearing things. You go into this hallucinogenic state. The belief becomes physiology and terror and all of this kind of stuff. And this is all coming from the perspective, too, that there aren't displays of horror that are also implemented into the act of so-called magic. For instance, if a sorcerer curses you, and then also they accompany this curse by constant, terrorizing of the victim, like intentionally terrorizing them constantly until that person dies, whether it's walking around their house chanting or watching them from the bushes or starting their cow on fire, whatever it is, this now becomes a spiritually heavy existence for this victim that will often probably end with a very horrifying ending. So, in conclusion, if you ask me, the phenomenon of magic and curses and voodoo deaths and all of this type of stuff, we've only just touched on it. There are so many areas that you can go into when it comes to this topic, but everything that I see suggests that human beings are not only haunted by spirits and curses, but they're also haunted by their own convictions and beliefs. When the mind accepts death as unavoidable, the body may begin searching for the path to obey the mind and eventually kill itself without the person ever having to put a gun to their head or a knife to their vein. Anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed this, and the life is in the blood. I'll talk to you soon.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.